And I'm sure you all know that sitting to my left is Antonio Damasio, with whom I will have a conversation tonight. But it's the best part is that I can get to ask the questions and hear, along with the rest of you, what Professor Damasio has to say. I should mention that this is the opening event for a invitational conference that begins tomorrow morning on the topic of usable knowledge in the area of mind, brain, and education. This is a conference that's been in the works for some time. Several speakers from the local area, as well as distinguished speakers from America and abroad, will be at that conference. Students here will be able to watch it in Guttman Library in closed circuit television, and eventually there will be a book and no doubt CDs and DVDs and dancing movies and so on based on the conference. But let me say a few words of introduction about Antonio Damasio, and welcome him back to the school, because just a couple of years ago he was here speaking about an earlier book, Filling Up What Happens. Antonio and his wife Hannah, who is also here, also a neuroscientist, came originally from Portugal, had their training there, and for the last 30 years they've been carrying out groundbreaking research at the University of Iowa Medical Center in Iowa City. Along the way, I can remember stops in Boston, Chicago, La Jolla, and lots of places abroad, especially old Europe. Is that right? Occasional trips to New Europe as well. Many people here are scholars or aspiring scholars. And as scholars, all of us want to make a contribution to knowledge. And the familiar figure of speech is we want to add a brick or two to the edifice of knowledge. And that's a worthwhile aspiration. Among all of us who want to do this, it's only a small number who do something or say something that other people notice and talk about. That's not something that you can guarantee. We try, but that's not entirely in our hands. There's even a smaller number of people who become part of what I'm going to call the public conversation of our time, the conversation that takes place within disciplines and across disciplines among people who are really leading thinkers, leading scholars, leading scientists. And the smallest category are the individuals who are actually able to change the topics of conversation, to introduce new ideas, new concepts, which people hadn't thought about before or alternatively thought they'd already solved, and to bring new attention to those topics and to redirect what people are talking about for the foreseeable future. Now, I'm sitting next to a gentleman who fits that description. I've been lucky enough to know Antonio for several decades. We actually shared a teacher in common, the great Norman Geschwind. We belong to some of the same professional organizations and have had our own informal conversations over the years. And I've marveled at the way that Antonio has been able to draw on knowledge from neuroscience, psychology, cognitive science, philosophy, most recently, ethics, the arts, and at least starting tonight, education. His scholarly papers are read and cited everywhere in the area of behavior and neurology. His books have each, the books that he began 10 years ago have each been landmark publications. These are books for the general public. He and Hannah have also done more technical books, and probably most people in this room know of, and many of you have read, Descartes' Error, The Feeling of What Happens, and most recently, Searching for Spinoza. These books are elegantly titled. I remember once introducing you and saying how in each case I thought that people wouldn't understand the title. In each case, I was proved wrong, so that behavior has been extinguished. But in addition to being elegantly titled, they are evocatively written, clearly and carefully argued, and each of them has move forward this precious conversation of our time. So needless to say, it's an honor to have a public conversation with Antonio tonight. And I'm going to do what we've learned how to do in the school, and that's to give you an advanced organizer. We're going to talk about three questions, and then if we have time, we're going to slip in a few more, and then we're going to open it up to questions and comments from you. Initially, I'm going to ask Antonio to tell us a bit about how his own ideas have developed over the years. Now, clearly, in such a productive life, it's only going to be some highlights, but he can focus on those things which I think will be important for the second and third question. The second question is, in your own work, what ideas and theories have you most tried to counter? And in turn, which of your ideas have been most misunderstood and why? And then third, as advertised, what do you think are the major insights and the major qualifications and cautions that those of us in education should have vis-a-vis research in biology, neuroscience, and genetics? And if there's extra time, we're going to ask you about what you're going to do next, including about your interest in movies and how we process the cinema. So that's the introduction, the advanced organizer. Tell us a bit about how you see, at this point in your life, the major developments in your work.
Okay. Do I have a chance to say something first?
The floor is yours.
Very good. So I have.
And there are no three lights, so you can go as long as you want.
No three lights, but I will say something is not just polite, unlike what we have seen in the debates, about the person who is asking the question. So it's a great pleasure to be here. First, I think it's going to be a very interesting conference, but it's most important because it's Howard Gardner. And Howard, as you said, we go a long way back, and we shared a mentor, Norman Geschwin, and there. Although one is in education, technically, and cognitive science, and the other is in neuroscience, I think we share a lot of interests, and we share culture, for sure. And it's always been a pleasure to talk to him, and I'm very honored to be asked questions by you. So,
thank you.
Now that we've taken care of that, and it's great to see Ellen there, too. I think that... The first question, we should dispose of it rather quickly because it's probably not very interesting. I think one changes a lot over time, and I can focus perhaps on two extremely important points in my career because I think they were points of great change. And one was the point at which I had to decide if I wanted to be a philosopher or a filmmaker, or a physician interested in the brain, which is what I became first.
You were stuck in PH, right?
Right. Something like that. But what all of those things had in common was that they had a lot to do with how one looks at the mind and with how one answers questions about the mind. And basically it all goes back to how is it possible that something like the brain can create something like the mind? And even before that, but only for a very short time, how is the mind organized to begin with? Those were my first interests. And there was a point at which I made that change, curiously with the help of a philosophy professor, who, after he heard what I was interested in, said very simply, what you want to become is a neurologist. At that time, neuroscience the name had not even been coined. One talked about neurology. Sometimes one talked about psychiatry because psychiatry was making also and had been a tradition of relating brain and mind. But it was not, there was no discipline called neuroscience. And it was not even traditional to have, for example, PhDs involved in research in this field. The research was all coming from MDs who went to medical school and trained either as neurologists or psychiatrists. And so that was a basic, very critical point in evolution of ideas. And after that, things became somewhat clear, and they became clear with the help of someone that Howard mentioned, and that was Norman Geschwind. At the time that I had this interest, and at the time that Hannah also had very similar interests when we met in medical school, we happened to read an incredibly powerful paper, which I'm sure influenced Howard very much, and that was a paper called Disconnection Syndromes in Animals and Men. It was not by that time necessary to write in animals and humans. So it was written, like, you know, in the good Darwinian tradition, as animals and men. And that paper, which is not really a paper, was really a book. It was a monograph published in two consecutive issues of Brain, was quite revolutionary because it took what was known of neurology at the time, and especially all the incredible history of neurology up to that point, and especially the neurology of the turn of the century, and it picked up the strands, and it said very clearly that there was a brain behind the mind. But not only that, is that the organization of that brain behind the mind could be understood in relation to abilities such as seeing, learning and recalling, using language. And it was fascinating to see that suddenly integrated. And it's very interesting because Norman Geschwind, and this was taking place in the mid-60s, had not at his disposal the techniques that emerged 10 years later, and had only, in fact, his good thinking, his very clear vision, and all the material that had been amassed by these great pioneer neurologists and psychiatrists and some neuropsychiatrists of the turn of the century and perhaps the first 20 years. And curiously, all of that had been lost. And in part under the sway of the developments in chemistry, and in part under the enormous popularity of psychodynamic thinking, the thought and the knowledge of classical neurology had been completely lost, and was, you know, was cultivated by a few exceptional individuals here and there, but the strand had been lost. And Norman Geschwind brought all that into being. People were fascinated, and people from very different walks of science got to find their own way. And we found, and I found in particular, my way into studying language, which was, in fact, one of Norman Geschwind's great interests. But in essence, what one ended up doing is clarifying this, breaking down processes and clarifying the relationship between those processes and a very general organization of the brain, which was all that was possible at the time. And for a long time, my interests were very focused on language and memory in particular. Later on, there's another breaking point that I think is very critical and has to do with something that almost happens by chance and has to do with encountering situations in which you really could not explain what was wrong with a particular patient or a particular set of patients, and which had apparently to do with the purely cognitive domain, because it had to do with how one makes decisions. And prompted by that, I decided to study this particular group of conditions and try to find out what could in fact be wrong, what could in fact be a possible explanation for those conditions. And I literally tumbled onto the field of emotion. I had never planned to study emotion. It's very interesting because it's quite curious how one can break, how one can separate in so clearly things that are in your day-to-day. If one considers yourself as a an appreciator of art, and if one wants to cultivate some art, even secretly, which is my case, you end up being very concerned with emotion. It's impossible not to. And yet, as a scientist, I was never concerned with emotion, but I became concerned with it and interested in it because I found out that there was no other way to explain some of these enormous disturbances of reasoning and decision-making except if we would go to an explanation that involved the disturbance of emotion. And that's a very big breaking point, and so that's a set of ideas.
We should probably say a bit about the patient or patients who may not be familiar to the audience, because it's kind of a level of abstraction which may not hit home.
So what was happening quite interestingly is that there were people that would, after sustaining a brain lesion in one particular system in the brain, in the frontal lobe, would not be able to reason and to make decisions the way they were before. And they would, in fact, there would be a complete separation between the period that anteceded the onset of the lesions and the period thereafter, where they would make decisions that were not advantageous to themselves and were not advantageous to, for example, their relatives. And these people would not be able to run their social behavior in a normal way. They could, in fact, in some cases, become disrespectful of social conventions or even of ethical rules. And the traditional way of explaining these defects is that something has gone wrong with the use of logic or the use of knowledge such that you no longer can make those decisions in a rational way. And in fact, what was very apparent is that these people did not have fundamental problems of knowledge, not even of knowledge access, and they did not have problems of, for example, tackling a logical problem. So something else had to provide an explanation for these very pure cases in which this was happening. And to make a long story short, it turns out that a very important disturbance of emotion was at the root of the problem, and that in fact by literally flattening out the possibility to emote in certain circumstances and the possibility of selecting through an emotional action a particular kind of option, these people were being prevented from reasoning in an effective and normal way. So that's a very important point. And from there on, I think that most everything has organized around the work that I did after, and that has to do with the physiology of emotion, with the physiology of emotion and its consequent process, which is feeling, and the enormous repercussions that has in the entire system, in terms of the way one learns, in terms of the way one consolidates knowledge, in terms of the way even one accesses knowledge. And I think that that's really where I am right now, still developing material that has to do with emotion. The comment that I would make is that it's interesting that you can be oriented towards a general question. The question in my case was, how is the brain organized such that it can produce a mind, and a mind as intriguing as human mind is? And then it becomes deflected, or it becomes oriented by things that you very often do not plan for. It would be completely false to say that I have had a grand plan to end up studying emotion and be where I am now in my interests on emotion and the repercussions of those interests. It was never planned that way. Probably what I would have ended up doing had I not come into this particular set of cases was something that would be related to language and memory, which were my primary interests. Now, As that happened, I then realized something interesting, and this relates to your second question, which has to do with what are ideas that you think you are fighting against or have to fight for, given what you do. And I found myself realizing that, in fact, I had been myself under the sway of a very powerful cognitive paradigm, which you and I were very intrigued by in the first part of our lives, and which was extremely important because, in fact, it completely changed the behaviorist view of brain and mind that, if there was a mind, that preceded it. But what I found is that, in fact, I had always been looking at the brain until maybe 15, 20 years ago, as if we were always coming top down. There were things like reasoning and decision making, processes related to language or to learning, processes related to, say, mathematical processing. And all of that was there, and it was not hooked to two things which I now consider fundamental. And one was emotion in the very general sense of the term, and the other was biological regulation in a broader sense of the term. One could read that as connected to the body as such. In fact, I think that one of the you can look in the history of neuroscience and you can find that. You can find that the interests are, and in fact have been in the 20th century and throughout most of the development of what we now know as neuroscience post-1970, the interests have been on this upper cognitive layer. And the
Descartes' error, we might say.
It is in a way, because there was that focus, because obviously we deal with ideas, we deal with choices that we make every day, we deal with language and learning and remembering, and that's what dominates our life to a great extent. And so it's very easy not to notice something else that is there, somewhat lurking in the background, but I think it's more, it's there all the time in a permanent background, which is emotion and feeling, and also to ignore the role that those emotions and feelings can have in the entire process of reasoning, the entire process of choosing and creating.
I think it's very important, if I could interject
sure.
here for making sense of this, that it wasn't the case that psychologists and neuroscientists were unaware of emotions. And if you took a look in a textbook, there'd always be in a chapter called Emotions. And, you know, I remember many discussions with Norman Geschwind about emotions, both in reference to right hemisphere disease and to temporal lobe epilepsy and to the famous Flynn cat experiments, which you know. But it was the notion of underscoring the relationship of emotions and feelings to rationality,
right.
Which was that's what you didn't find in textbooks.
Right, exactly. It's that connection, because you would have it there compartmentalized. So obviously one would talk about it, but there would be a sort of a lip service paid to that phenomenon without making the central connection that it could have and in fact does have. And then the connection of emotion to biological regulation. So here, let's just say a couple of words about that. Is that, and that connection has a lot to do with the split, not just the Cartesian split between mind and body in the broad sense of the term, but with the split between brain with its mind and body, as if in fact one could have a body. That one could have a brain that somehow would have developed without any kind of connection to the organism of which it is a part, without any kind of connection to the body, which is in fact meant to regulate. And so this split is an extremely critical one. And the way I view things now is, of course, quite different. If you take an evolutionary perspective, what I think we have in our organisms, in our brains, is an incredibly beautiful story of how you cope with one central problem, and that is the problem of surviving, and the problem of surviving with well-being. I think that in any kind of organism that you find, and in fact, even in organisms that don't have a brain, and there are, for example, unicellular organisms, already within the master controller of those unicellular organisms, for example, at the level of the nucleus in a cell, you find an organization that will permit that living organism to maintain itself for a certain span of life, and to seek during that period the conditions which will allow it to thrive. So in fact, I think it is all, especially when you look at it from the human perspective, about the problem of A, surviving, and then surviving while flourishing. And it's a word that I use on purpose. May not be the most popular word to use, but I really think it's about the problem of surviving and flourishing. And so the brain, I think, has evolved under numerous pressures in certain environments precisely to cope with that problem. It is always about coping with that problem. And you find that coping sometimes in very simple mechanisms, which, again, a unicellular organism can have even without a brain, and then organisms with very simple brains can have. And then you find something quite remarkable when complexity gets to be enough, is that the brains get very, very rich, and the brains get rich enough they can actually look at the whole world, they can have sensory processing, and they can eventually be able to cope with the control in a way that includes what we, in the traditional sense, call a mind, a way of dealing with thoughts, a way of dealing with ideas, and eventually making plans and using imagination. But that, in a way, and I think this is the critical point for me, that comes later in evolution, the same way that I think it comes later in development, in individual development. We don't start quite that way, and we didn't start that way. So all those things that we were studying 30 years ago are the top layers of the cake, not the bottom. And the critical point is that that top, the things that we call reasoning and decision-making and the creativity we have, all of that is still hooked very solidly, both in the diagrammatic sense as well as in the true brain sense, to all of this organization which we harbor inside our brains and which has become a sort of great master controller of the economy within our organisms, the life that goes on in the hearts and the lungs and the bloodstream, which is all totally connected with what goes on in the mind, which is, of course, the reason why you can get sick in your body if you are not very well in your mind, and vice versa.
And you didn't even say that you had an aspiration to be a poet in early life. But,
no,
your vision is very poetic. Yeah. But I want to work through this outline now. Question number one was, what are the major changes that took place in your intellectual development? And you very artfully talked about how you got interested in the whole issue of what do we know about the mind through brain and other kinds of studies, clinical studies, and then how, while you were kind of like a cognition uber alles person for the first years of the cognitive revolution, you then focused more and more on issues having to do with emotion in the body, and that really eventually transformed Copernically how you think about the whole mental enterprise. I do want you to talk, Antonio, if you would, about which of the ideas that you've developed, you know, the role of emotions, their relationship to reason, the brain as being the instrument which allows our bodies to survive and thrive. Which of those has been most difficult for serious people who are trying to understand your ideas to get, and how have they misinterpreted them?
Probably the two steps in that difficulty. One clearly is gone and was probably, I don't know, 15 years ago. And as you were asking then, I was thinking about a great friend of ours who died very recently, and that's Francis Crick. And for me, the difficulty in relation to that idea is epitomized by my conversations with Francis Crick. When I first told Francis that I was studying emotion, and when I first brought him results that we had, he looked at it, he listened very politely, and he said, so Antonio, are you really interested in this? Really? And he just couldn't see the point of studying emotion. And this is easily one of the most brilliant men ever, responsible for probably the leading discovery in the 20th century in science, and who was completely blocked in relation to emotion. He wanted to talk about, you know, in fact, we started talking many years before because of my interest in visual perception and in visual knowledge. It was really all about visual agnosia, a condition in which patients, after a certain lesion in the visual system, lose the ability to recognize faces that were previously familiar. And this is quite a dramatic situation, and we worked a lot on this, and we found ways of accounting for this defect, and now it's something that is studied all the time, and there are all sorts of interesting developments there. But this is the kind of thing he was interested in. He was interested in the purely cognitive aspect, and he didn't think that emotion would be an interesting thing to study. And it's very interesting that I have an explanation for that. It's just because he was such an incredibly happy person. You know, I got the clue to that once I called his home, and his wonderful wife, Odile, picked up the phone, and I said, could I talk to Francis? He said, of course. Let me see where he is. I saw him walk by with a glass of champagne just a minute ago. And this was about noon. And I said, ah, that's the life. And he was profoundly happy, and he was, in fact, he was, you know, he was working until the eve of his death at 88, and he sent me an email. He sent an email to me and Hannah 2 weeks before and one the night before. And it said, dear Antonio, I need to know what happens with lesions of the claustrum, which is a rather recondite area of the brain, which he was working on at the time because of his interest in consciousness. But so this happiness actually kept him working and interesting. Oh, I digress. But the point is that that difficulty was actually not uncommon at all from people who had that orientation. What was very welcoming for me is that there was no such difficulty, for example, at the level of graduate students and postdocs that one talked to, and there was no difficulty whatsoever in people who were outside mainstream neuroscience. People just embrace the idea and said, how could it be otherwise?
Well, when students first take psychology, that's what they expected it to be about. And the kind of stuff that occupied Crick for 20 years, visual perception, seems very exotic to the man in the street.
Exactly. So there was a complete reversal, and I decided, well, I just have to bear with it and see what happens. And so that kind of difficulty has been completely overcome. The difficulty that I would imagine is I face right now, or we face, those of us who work in the kind of work that we do, is a certain fear that somehow neuroscience, neurobiology in general, is taking over A, psychology in the traditional sense, B, philosophy, which is a very crazy idea, if you want to hear my opinion, because there is no such intent, so it's not mine. But there is a fear that somehow as you have more successes in finding out about how a certain process can possibly be organized, that the explanations that invoke only a neural level are going to be the explanations that prevail, and that all the very hard work of being subtle and looking at it from a more traditional cognitive side are going to be lost, and worse of all, that the traditional way of discussing very complex problems of this nature in philosophy would be lost as well. And I think that that's entirely wrong, because, you know, I will concede that there are probably people who have been very successful in neuroscience and who probably are a bit careless in the way they present their results. Or if they're not careless, then the media ends up being careless, because things are presented constantly as this big discovery or that big discovery, and this part of the brain, which is invariably called center in the New York Times, it does this, you know, there's a center for love or a center for reasoning and so on. And this, of course, gives a very bad reading of what is happening in neuroscience. So there are people in neuroscience that probably think in very primitive ways, like in every other discipline, and we just let them be. That doesn't mean that everybody that is doing neuroscience and that wants to understand how the brain works and wants to relate it to this beautiful thing called the mind processes is that gross. And the other thing is that there is an attempt at sometimes at sort of there's the misinterpretation that you would somehow reify the idea of mind, that you would turn mind into a thing, that you would turn mind into something solid like the brain, or that you would confuse the mind and the brain. And I don't think that, of course, is necessarily the case, and I don't know of any of the best thinkers in our field that would want to subscribe to that. And so I think that that's a resistance.
It's possible that Trix Parker might, though.
I'm sorry?
Watson, I think, is much more susceptible to that kind of thinking.
Could be, yes.
Yeah, but that's a gossip point. Let's talk a bit about the announced topic for this evening.
Good.
Most people in this audience are involved in education, either as teachers or as researchers who are going to be working in schools and other learning environments like museums. And we're all aware of the cascading results from neuroscience, genetics, and so on. And I think there's some apprehension, as you pointed out. But I'm interested in how you think about the issue of the relationship between how many members now belong to the Society of Neuroscience? Tens of thousands, right?
Yes.
Relationship between...
So the 30,000 in the U.S., which includes a lot of international members, and there was just a European Congress of Neuroscience with 5,000 members, just met in Lisbon.
And you're absolutely right. I remember when the Sloan Foundation coined the phrase neuroscience. Yeah. It was in our lifetime.
Yeah, right. So anyway, in fact, the society was formed only in 1971. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm. So what is the way you think about the relationship of this amassing knowledge and the traditional challenge to educators, which is to take a range of young people, usually, give them knowledge from the past, prepare them to learn new things in the future, and give them some skills so when they leave the formal educational environment, they'll have minds which they want to continue cultivating.
Right. Well, I think it's a very natural relationship. It's the first thing that comes to my mind. In fact, why I would wonder how is it possible not to see and not to seek that relationship. And, you know, you can see something very simple. I don't think that there is any, I imagine there is no opposition in the field of education to psychology in the traditional sense, to cognitive science in general. And since there is, and so I assume everybody would agree that knowledge from the various fields of psychology and cognitive science in the even broader sense have had an impact in education and have probably allowed people to illuminate some of what goes on in the educational process. Since there is no incompatibility between cognitive science and neuroscience, I would imagine that the three parts will get together. In other words, education, traditional cognitive psychology, cognitive science, and neuroscience are just natural aspects of understanding the same thing. We're all interested in understanding the mind, and it is certainly not possible to understand the mind in its fullest sense without understanding the brain and where it all comes from. I would find it very defective knowledge, even if I have the highest respect for everything that has been gathered in mind studies prior to knowing about the brain. So I find the connection very, very clear. I was thinking, actually, when you think about this, I was thinking about the connection to you. When you think about the theory of multiple intelligences, I would imagine that when you put together, when you laid out the fundamental ideas, you were not, well, I know that you were not doing it in terms of brain structures or brain function. You were doing it as a cognitive scientist.
But with lots of attention. I would not have done it without the brain knowledge. I would not even have thought of the question.
Right.
It probably goes back to disconnection syndrome.
It probably goes back to non-negation. So there's that common root. But what is interesting is that now, 20 years after the theory of multiple intelligences, we can see, as neuroscientists, that there is quite a lot of solid grounding for your ideas in neuroscience, because without it, I don't think anybody who is doing neuroscience or knows anything about it will not see how patently clear it is that people have enormously different organizations of the intelligence process and how it can be more focused in one or another aspect and how that hooks very directly with different neural systems that are responsible for the emphasis in one aspect or another of that very rich, variegated mind. So I think you have already been doing this connection. So I think that the only thing one needs to do is do more of it and expand it and allow, you know, I would, the way I see, I want to learn a lot about what goes on in the world of education. That's why this conference is so interesting. But I would imagine that people that work in education would want to know more about what is going on in neuroscience, because that way they will know more about what is going on in the mind and they can relate that to a variety of problems that are encountered when you go through this very intriguing process of changing another mind. I'm not plugging your book. But just one more thing is that I even suspect, and this, of course, I don't know if it will turn out to be or not, that it might be relevant. This is a question, not an affirmation. It might be relevant for people in education that have to design curricula and that have to design techniques of teaching. I would think it would be not very sensible to want to do that only on the basis of what is known in common sense or in just a field of psychology, because there are probably very interesting things that go on in the brain that may be relevant.
Antonio, I want to turn it over to the audience, but I want to ask you one question, and it's a difficult question. It's been asked of me, and I haven't had great answers to it, but I want to ask it of you. I don't think anybody would publicly say in this room at this time that one shouldn't know about the mind and possibly also about the brain if you want to be an educator. Though I can also say that when Kurt Fischer and I tried to convince the faculty here that we should have a mind, brain, and education major, this was 5 years ago or so, there was actually objection to the word brain. So it's not quite as innocent as you might think. But the question I want to ask you is this. You know as much about neuroscience as anyone. You do teaching. You may not teach that much in this kind of a setting, but you teach medical people all the time. Is there anything that you do differently in your own teaching because of what you know about the mind and the brain?
In relation to what I know about the brain, yes. Yes. It's a qualified yes, because I'd say that it's things that one introduces, but without a very formal way of organizing that shift. But before I do that, I just wanted to, if possible, before we go to the audience, to give you some examples of things that I find are very critical, and that probably could give the audience a better idea of why I think it is relevant to know about the brain, or it may be relevant, or I think it is. And maybe one could think about two or three examples, and maybe that would also help frame the discussion for you. You might want to go back to it. One would probably have to do, again, with emotion. Let me just tell you a little story very quickly to give you an idea of what I have in mind. I told you about those patients who are, of course, adult patients that we studied and that prompted me to look into emotion as a factor in the appearance of something that was a disorder of, in effect, social conduct that appeared out of the blue in adult life, post damage to the brain. In recent years, and this really has started around the late 90s, the first paper we published on this was in 1999, we found something very intriguing, and is the following. If you have children who sustain a brain lesion in certain parts of the brain, when those children grow up and go through adolescence and then to young adulthood, lo and behold, they exhibit disturbances of their social conduct that are extremely similar to the ones that adults with similar lesions will have. And so we were very intrigued by this, because what we were finding, and this came because parents brought us those children who are no longer children because they're in their 20s, what we were finding is that those individuals had in fact been regarded throughout most of their life as some variation of a psychopath. In fact, there was hardly any visible history of brain damage, although one could find the brain damage once one inquired about it, and it generally had happened within the first 5 years, and most often within the first two. And so the interesting thing was that here there was a profound and yet subtle, because it had not been noticed, it had hardly been recorded, damage inflicted on a nervous system of a very young child, which then has an influence in the remainder of the development, and curiously enough, the influence is extremely confined to the social domain, and in fact one could say that most other aspects of the capacities of that child were left intact. For example, intelligence in the traditional IQ sense, the kind that Howard has been fighting against because it is too narrow a concept, is preserved in those individuals, and they're regarded as smart but somewhat evil, to use a common term popular now. So what we thought was that this was very intriguing, and we studied it in more detail, and in fact we published it as soon as we could because we wanted to see if other individuals of this with this problem could come forth. And in fact, many have. And in fact, now there's a whole project studying this. But what is very interesting, and I think would be, I imagine, relevant for your business, is that when you study those now young adults, you find that they're very similar to the adults that had the lesions appearing in adult age, except that they were never able to learn the rules of behavior that they were supposed to follow and the rules that they are in fact breaking. Whereas the adults, when they break the rules, they know, once asked, that they have broken the rules. So you have here a very interesting separation. Children with these lesions, so far in the observations that have been made, appear never to be able to master what are proper rules of social conduct and appear not to be able to master, for example, basic ethical rules. Whereas the adults were able to master those rules, and even if they flaunt them, if asked, they'll say, yes, I know that this is wrong. And they are confronted. It doesn't mean that they correct their behavior. The bad behavior continues, but they did have the knowledge. So this is telling us that there is something very particular that failed to be learned as a result of the damage, and that could not be compensated for. One other layer of intrigue in this story is that we all know that when very young children suffer damage to parts of the brain that are related to language, there is in fact a remarkable compensation, especially if the damage occurs before age 5. And so while the system that has been appropriated for language gets to be compensated for once it is no longer functioning right, this system that one could say is a system devoted to social conduct and to ethical behavior does not show that kind of compensation. Yeah. And the final trick here, which is very interesting, is that we don't believe for a second that there is anything like a system devoted to social conduct and ethics. Rather, what there is here is a disturbance that led to the loss of what one would call the emotional rudder that would have allowed educators, the parents and the school, to, for example, introduce mechanisms of reward or of punishment that would have, in fact, allowed for a development of, for example, normal social conduct. So it's not the case that we think that there's a social conduct center or a moral center that has been damaged. It's in a way simpler but graver than that, in the sense that what has been lost in those children is the ability to manipulate situations and to mark those situations as positive or negative from an affective point of view. And the most intriguing of all is the fact that it is still possible to have an otherwise cognitive system that operates and it allows these children to learn a lot and be very smart on certain measures.
Of course, the educational challenge is normally in these injured kids it doesn't happen. But it's possible it might happen, just like Temple Grandin, who's mm-hmm. autistic, has learned a set of rules
yeah.
which allows her to make the inferences about other people's motivation, which you can't do on,
right.
you know,
right.
Cheney Edwards kinds of clues, yes. so to speak.
Exactly. But I think what is important here is to see this. It's not, I'm not suggesting for a second that you go and use this for, or that this is of any consequence for what you're doing today. But what it may be is, it may be of consequence to thinking that there are many other systems and many other situations where knowledge of this kind can be gathered, and it is possible that some of this knowledge will be relevant to what you do. I'm using it as a model system. And one other system that I thought about that might be interesting, because it has to do with an old interest, language. And it's a story that is still developing, but it is intriguing. Many years ago, when we were actually still in Portugal, we got very interested by the following idea. We knew that, you know, Portugal is a curious country in old Europe that has some large cities where life is very modern and everything functions right. And there's also a thing called the countryside, where people are in fact very wise, do not live in a backward way in the traditional sense of the term, and yet very often they were not literate. They were not taught to read and write. So we got intrigued by the idea, this was in the mid-70s, of finding out if you have people that are intelligent, that are capable, that are very wise, that behave as independent individuals in society, but have not learned how to read, would their brain organization be different? And the way we went about it was to collect every possible bit of information on such individuals that were illiterate but smart, etc., and had strokes as a result of which they had aphasia. And our question was, could it be that if you are illiterate, you will actually end up not having aphasia, which is the term for a disturbance of language caused by brain damage, with the same kind of damage that we know causes aphasia in a literate individual. And this is because we know very well, especially after Norman Gashwin, that there are certain patterns of aphasia where you can, for example, lose more of your semantic processing, or lose more of your syntactic processing, and those are related to extremely predictable parts of the brain. In fact, you can listen to a patient, talk to the patient, and you can venture a diagnosis of where precisely in the left hemisphere the damage is going to be. And then the scans will confirm that. So the question is, could it be that these illiterate people that had never been subject to the likes of you and never been educated in that traditional sense through, for example, a learning to read method of whatever kind, and learning to write, could it be that their brain organization would be different? And the answer was, at that first level, no. At that first level, what we found is that even if you were an illiterate aphasic, you would have aphasia with damage in the predictable areas of a perfectly literate person. Interestingly, one of my students, in fact, my first student in Portugal, who is now a professor of neurology in Lisbon, decided to take this further in the age of modern functional neuroimaging. And he decided to take very similar groups and see, okay, the areas may be grossly the same, but could it be that there's something within these areas that is functioning differently? And the answer is yes. The answer is that the patterns of activation are different, but the intensity, for example, with which certain areas are recruited in normal individuals who are either literate or illiterate is different. And I think this is an example that I think relates directly to your work, and that is that you can have largely the same brain organization which is given to males and females and is given to the literate and the illiterate. And yet, within that basic macro organization, you can organize a functional anatomy that is different, and that will be different in different conditions, and that probably will be very different depending on the kind of learning, on the kind of education that you have been subject to. And this is something that has also another curious example in what we now know from functional imaging experiments about what happens in the brain when someone is learning a skill, for example, a musical skill. The representation, for example, of the fingers that a person who plays the violin or plays the piano will have is different from the person who does not. Not only that, with different degrees of practice, the representation of the fingers is going to change. And there's going to be a constant fluctuation with peaks and valleys that is related to that educational process, this learning of a skill. So I think that there are numerous ways in which findings of this sort could be, I think, of relevance, if nothing else, to understand what is going on. Maybe they won't have any other practical value, but at least that, I think, is possible. And I could give you many other examples, perhaps even more beautiful than these.
It should be evident that I would have 100 more questions, but I think it's high time to go to the audience. There are stationary mics, and I think it's most efficient if people will let this gentleman start, but if other people would stand at the mics, give your name and a succinct question.
Yeah. Stephen Campbell, Simon Fraser University. I'll try and keep my classroom voice. As an educational researcher, understanding of the relationships between educational practice and neuroscience, one would hope that we would be able to develop theoretical frameworks and methodologies that would be particularly germane to helping these relationships be built. And so with regard to the theoretical framework, I can think of no other two people that I would rather address this question to. The paradigms of cognitive science, the symbolic paradigm, the connectionist paradigm, and more lately the embodied paradigm of Francisco Varela and colleagues, all seem to be vying for our attention in terms of how we understand mind-brain relations. So my question would be, how do you gentlemen see, if I may address this to both of you, the relationship between these three paradigms, and which one do you think would be most conducive to educational research and expediting relations between neuroscience and educational practice?
Yeah, this is obviously a knowledgeable question, but why don't you take a crack at it? I'll do the usable part.
I think the first thing I would say is that I don't think, you use a very curious word, three different paradigms vying for our attention. And I don't think they need to vie for the attention, and I don't think that you need to choose one over the others. I think that what one has to do is pick what is usable and most convenient for a particular purpose, because I actually don't think, you know, I will not tell you which of those three paradigms is closer to mine. You probably can guess. But I would not want to do away with the things that the other two can contribute. And I think that we are in a process of constant change in relation to the knowledge we have. You sort of reorganize, a little bit like our memory, you see. The idea that we consolidate a memory and it sticks there and stays forever as the memory of a particular person or event is perfectly false, because we're constantly reorganizing that memory, we're constantly recategorizing memories, and we probably, when we recall something, we actually go through some kind of reconsolidation of what we just recalled. So they're all, we've constantly, there's a constant flux here, and what I would do is pick and choose. And this is not just being pragmatic, maybe it is being pragmatic, but I think we need to do that, because although Howard was very kind and talked about progress in neuroscience and about how knowledgeable some of us are, the fact is that we're incredibly ignorant. And a lot of this knowledge is extremely, it's not quite flimsy, because, you know, this, the knowledge is quite solid, or at least some of it is, but it is so open to change, it's so open to updating, that to fix oneself in one paradigm, I think it's just a mistake. You just need to be open.
I'm happy to give you my answer privately, but I think we should let people ask questions of Antonio.
First, you know, thank you so much, Professor Damasia. It was a wonderful talk, and I've been reading your journal, you know, in neurology. I train as an MD. You know, when I talk about, you know, the vast field of neuroscience, I think, you know, we try to boil something, right? The big area of neuroscience, you know, we try to borrow something, you know, from the neuroscience that might be applicable to education. So we create a hybrid called neuroeducation, someone coined the term probably more than 2 decades ago. But, you know, not all neuroscience are useful, you know, in education. For instance, like those high-level people, they are talking about dynamic closed system, you know, mathematical modeling, you know, usually throw people away. And those people, they are working downstream on a molecular level, you know, friends like Eric Kandel, you know, wonderful Nobel laureate in neuroscience. Doesn't mean that his research is not useful in education, but it's more on protein level, you know, we talk about synaptic. But I think those areas that I find directly, you know, very relevant to neuroeducation is the neurobiology of learning and memory. But you mentioned something, you know, very striking, is that you feel your emotion. You know, this new, you know, not too many people talk about in neurology, but more people talk about in psychiatry, you know. I wonder, you know, does it overlap with the area of, you know, Gerald Edelman's, you know, consciousness? When you say you feel, you know, your emotion, you mean you are awareness of something. You know, with relevant to education is that, can we do something like conscious learning versus, you know, unconscious or subconscious learning?
Okay. Let's see if I deal with your question. First, you touched on something that is very important, which is that because neuroscience is extremely complex,
right,
which comes from the fact that the brain has many levels of organization, there are obviously certain things that are going to appear very exotic and unrelated to day-to-day life. And one of the things that I think is so remarkable about education is that education does relate to everyday life. You know, we're all in it. We're all being educated ourselves. We all were educated. And many of you, probably all of you, are involved in educating, which is really something quite, you know, quite spectacular when you think about it, because it's probably unique in the biological world. You know, there's some kind of teaching going on in animals. No, nobody would doubt that. But pedagogy, the way we conceive it, and this idea that you're going to that you're going to voluntarily try to modify another mind is really something quite spectacular and quite unique in terms of what is going on in the living world. But I would advise you not to write off certain levels of neuroscience just because they don't appear relevant immediately or they don't appear relevant to the today. For example, you mentioned Eric Kandel. Well, true, you're not going to probably design a curriculum around the key discovery or the key set of findings in his career. And yet, here's something that is very important. We know that when you learn something, and this is certainly true for the learning of facts, probably it's true for the learning of skills, probably it's true for the learning of anything, you have to undergo a process in which, to begin with, you change the pattern of activity in your brain in multiple areas, not one center, not two, you know, dozens very often. They change that activity, but then it will only be locked in. It will only be consolidated in a memory if there's something that is, in fact, a physical change. And that physical change has to happen at the level of the synapses. And there has to be a certain cascade of enzymes that go into action under the influence of certain genes that are going to go into action at that point, not the genes that made us look the way we look, but rather certain genes that will only intervene at that point. And something is going to happen in a few million neurons at that point that changes the way those neurons will work the next time around. Now, I don't think that you want to not know about that, and I don't think that you want to ignore it completely in your day-to-day life, let alone in education, because you're dealing with this. This thing has to happen in order for a brain to gather and be the base for knowledge. Not only that, that process is going to be influenced by lots of things, not just by what you teach and the so-called neutral state of that brain. It's going to be influenced, for example, by the diet that the individual who has that brain has been subject to. It's going to be influenced by the state of mind of that individual in terms of how nervous or not nervous he is, what kind of environment that child is going on, is having at home. So all of those factors are going to contribute to what will be the success or not success of the educational experience, I would imagine. Now, even so, I'll grant you that there is something that one could call the systems level of brain organization and function, which happens to be the one we're most interested in, that is very immediate in relation to a lot of the day-to-day activities and in relation to education, because that's exactly where you can talk about a general function of memory or language or emotion. But let's not ignore the fact that underneath there are all of these other levels without which things are not going to work, and which may in fact turn out to be very relevant. For example, to discover that there are certain periods in normal development that they may be more critical for learning certain things, which may in fact turn out to be the case. And I don't think we're going to find that out by systems level studies only at a very high level. We need to do something that relates to the lower levels of organization.
But and Professor, to your surprise, you know, in education we have something called mindset. No matter how change in the molecular protein synaptic level,
yeah,
if your mindset's right there, you know, the output would be the same, regardless of the learning experience. That's why, you know, the most relevant thing I think about of the, you know, overlapping between the neuroscience and education is the neuroplasticity and metaplasticity. This is a paradox. You know, the neuron has
I'm going to ask you to continue this later because there are a few more questions and we don't have much time.
Sorry.
Thank you.
But I thank you for your question. And I think that the very important point is to keep the idea that this is not the brain and neuroscience is not a monolithic thing. You have all of these very different layers of study and knowledge, which come from the fact that the brain is so complex and has an organization that is absolutely unique. And I think many of them are going to turn out to be relevant.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please.
Dr. Damasio, thank you for coming and speaking to us. My name is Jane Ehrenfeld. I'm a third grade teacher in Boston. And as you were describing this, the scenario of a child who has this specific kind of brain lesion, I actually was picturing a very specific child in my class this year who kind of fits to a T what you were talking about. And I guess my question is just, what now? You know, what do you say to a parent? What do you do as a teacher when you're dealing with the possibility of this having occurred in a child's brain?
Right. Well, I think that you raise the question. And you study it, and obviously you're not going to be able to study it alone, but there will be people who will help you study the situation. And then there are two things that I think are important. One, what do you need to change in what you do to accommodate the life of that child. In the second, and that is not for you to worry about, but it's certainly for medicine and neuroscience to worry about, is what can be done to remedy that problem over and above what you will do as a human being and as a society to compensate for what seems to be a problem. And obviously, we don't know. And that's why it's interesting to study. It raises all sorts of questions. But the reason why we want to be aware of this is so that you can, for example, one of the main questions, one of our collaborators is involved in a project in which the central question is, would it be possible to alter anything in the future of a child in whom that is recognized early on from the point of view of neurology? And the answer is, of course, we don't know. It needs to have far more work. But it could be, of course, that problem that you have identified and that, curiously, we're now finding is far more common than not. It does not need to be precise. It does not need to have precisely the same cause. It may be something that is presenting the same way. The phenotype is the same. But it doesn't mean to say that that's exactly the same cause, because there are many ways of ending up with that kind of problem, or at least there will be some.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would add there are actually some people in this audience who know a lot about this, so you might not be alone, and maybe afterwards they might connect with you. I think we'll have to take just the last two questions, because we have a kind of a 7:30 bewitching hour.
We started late.
Well, certainly these two, okay?
Dr. Damasio, thank you. I'd like you to just speak a little bit about the ethics and social responsibility of where this science leads us, and specifically with education. You know, now, you know, we have a phenomena of exam schools where children are subjected to a lot of testing and interviewing before it's determined that they'll qualify for a particular level of educational benefit. And could you foresee a time when instead, they will be subjected to functional and structural imaging, and that will somehow determine their intellectual potential? And what does that really mean for us as a society?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if I can foresee anything like that. My first reaction is one of rejection of that prospect. But the honest answer is that I don't know. I think that you have we have obligations as a society to discuss all sorts of developments that are going on in science and their application. I don't like the idea that you would not want to allow the science to be done that would permit you to understand something. But whether or not you're going to use, to apply the knowledge to one thing or another is very much a matter of debate for a civilized society, for a civilized culture. You know, it's the same thing as when people ask me, which very often they have, well, the fact that you know that somebody has a brain dysfunction and that person is not making voluntary decisions, is not making decisions that he or she fully controls, does that mean that that person is not responsible if the person commits a crime? Or what would you do different? Should that person be free? And I think that there are certain aspects that one can answer this question very easily. One is that society has the absolute right and obligation to protect itself against the person who would be nefarious to the society. I don't think anybody would argue about that. But then beyond that, it's very tricky, because my tendency is to respond, well, what you have, if you have in fact a diagnosis, is the fact that you're dealing with the patient. And there the complexity of the problem changes. You have to deal with that person who happens to be sick. But that would take us in a very, very, very far away discussion. But I think the ultimate point is that we don't know, and we have to be just very humble about it, and to confess that we are in certain aspects of science, and neuroscience is just one minor aspect of it, we're way in advance of a complete manner in which society has digested the consequences of having that knowledge when it comes to certain applications. You just have to agree that that's the case and be open-minded about what you can do in the future.
Final question.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you both for speaking to us tonight. My question is in part a reaction to your comment to the third question that you expected that the learnings in neuroscience would join with the learnings of psychology and make their way into the general awareness of educational practice. But I think in my observation, kind of as an end user of education, that teachers today tend to focus entirely on behavior management with an assumption that if a child's behavior can be managed, then they'll be able to learn. But I don't think that's really compatible with a notion of a child who is an organism who has perhaps genetic dispositions and neural dispositions to be a certain kind of person. So one of the paradigm questions.
May I interrupt you?
Sure.
In what way is that not compatible? Because you're not saying that those genetic arrangements are not there, are you?
No.
Okay.
No, but I think that in my experience with educators is that they tend to ignore that.
Oh, okay.
That's irrelevant to the educational process. That, in fact,
and what do you think? Do you think that it is irrelevant or not?
Well, I don't think it's irrelevant.
Good.
Okay. And that was partly what I was going to ask you, and maybe about, in a sense, a different version of the previous question. One of the things that I think is kind of a paradigm difference that I'd ask you to comment on is in your example of sociopaths and in the context of a classroom, if you have a child who's being bad, do you, as a teacher, address the moral content of their behavior, or do you address the underlying cause of it?
Oh, I think I think the moral content of their behavior would actually not describe the whole thing, but certainly that's what you have to be concerned with. But I think that you don't need to be. It won't hurt to know that in some circumstances there will be certain behaviors that will be the result of a dysfunction of some sort, or that there will be behaviors that are not really dysfunctions but temporary arrangements that are the result of a certain way of mind-brain working in a particular social context, etc., etc. So I don't think you need to be a neurological diagnostician and be on the alert for the case that you need to detect and deal with that as a pathological case. I certainly think that that would be an abomination. But it wouldn't hurt to know what's behind it. So the basic idea is to inform, to know more about what is going on. And then you can draw whatever conclusions you may need, or your group, or the culture. It may turn out to be that, in fact, knowing about these things is very relevant in the classroom, or that it is perfectly of no consequence. I'm totally open to either. But I certainly do not. I look at these things with a grain of salt. I'm very interested in finding out how systems operate, how certain things occur, but I have no, for example, I have no desire to neurologize creative behavior. I think it would be pretty pathetic, although I've seen it attempted, to try to explain why a great painter painted what he did or not on the basis of some kind of pathology that the person happened to have. I don't think that that's really what one should be interested in. However, I'm perfectly open to the possibility of understanding brain mechanisms behind creativity. I think that's a fascinating discipline. But no, I don't want to explain Jackson Pollock's paintings on the basis of the fact that he was a severe alcoholic. Although it may have something to do with it, but, you know, it's not a good, it's not going to be a good explanation. It's just going to miss most of the point, I would imagine. And I think the same thing would apply to education. And please, in relation to the way you were describing the genetic propensities of a given child, it's there, the genetic part, as well as all the acquired biological part. I think one of the big problems that we're facing is that in our culture, very often, you separate. I mean, not only do you have all these funny separations of mind and brain and mind and body and all of that bizarre stuff, but you also have this separation between what is genetic versus what is acquired, as if somehow the acquired had been acquired in a pure space of culture and mind that did not have a brain and an organism to support it. Well, it does. And in fact, genes are operating all the time, not just the ones that give us a certain physical characteristic, but also the ones that are totally engaged in allowing me, for example, to remember the conversation that I'm having with you. Lots of stuff going on there. Gene expression at a certain point without which I'm not going to remember anything of this conversation. And so it's very, you cannot conceive of what is going on intellectually and affectively. We cannot conceive of our feelings or any of that without this underpinning that in fact pervades the whole process. But that doesn't mean that we should sort of be less concerned with the mind level of the process or with all the stuff that you get to control when you have an expertise, for example, the expertise of a teacher.
Antonio, I think we're going to have to wait till your next visit here, which I hope will be soon, to ask you the question about what you and Hannah are going to be doing about the understanding of cinema through the lens of cognitive neuroscience. But until that time, let me thank you on behalf of everyone, not only for the knowledge and insight that you brought, but I think we all will take away the respectfulness and the care with which you talked about things and responded to our questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.